Arsenal for Democracy is freely available weekly at arsenalfordemocracy.com or Apple and Stitcher, and we're supported by some listeners at patreon.com/arsenalfordemocracy for $3 a month. The show is recorded and produced by me, Bill Humphrey, in Newton, Massachusetts. Our theme music is produced by Stuntbird. Follow us on Facebook or at AFD Radio on Twitter. The show is not affiliated with any campaign committee, and each participant's opinions are their own.
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy, episode 437, recorded on Sunday, August 14th, 2022. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me on the line from Boise, Idaho, as always, is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill.
Well, big news for the listeners. I've known Rachel for over a decade. We have now actually met in person for the first time, even though we've been doing this show consistently since the end of 2016 together. It was great to meet you in Idaho, Rachel. I've now been to this fabled Boise in which you record each week with these episodes, but it was a wonderful time, and thank you so much for having me out there.
Yeah, it was a great time. We went to the Idaho State History Museum, and I got to explore the history of my state that I haven't really looked at, and we found some fodder for some interesting future topics as well. So be on the lookout for those episodes coming in the future. And we'll have to post a picture on our Arsenal for Democracy Twitter feed.
That's right. Yeah, we got a picture with you and me, but also your sister Sarah, who had done some past hosting of this show that before you actually hosted this show. So she was the one that like helped make this happen in the first place. And like you said, we've got about a half dozen things that we think could be good episodes about Idaho in this period of American history that we haven't talked about yet or covered yet. And we're really excited about that. I also stopped off at the Colorado State History Museum in Denver on my way to see you, and also got another half dozen or so topics of really interesting things in Denver and Colorado history as well for potential future episodes. We're obviously not going to stack them all up at once, but they're going to be great ones to sprinkle through here and there. And it was just such an exciting and fun trip. And, you know, we, of course, ended up spending quite a bit of our time, as you said, just kind of sitting around planning out future episode ideas and talking about the show and talking about various books that we've been reading and things that might make good episodes as well. Let's get into this week's topic, though. This is another one that is going to be probably part of a set of episodes. Not sure if we're going to do them consecutively or break them up over time. We'll see. We haven't really done any episodes on American firefighting, whether in big cities or in the vast remote forests of the United States, but we have had a few ideas of some topics we wanted to cover in that arena. So today we'll be talking about early fire alarm systems and the Great Boston Fire of 1872, 150 years ago this November. We're getting a bit of a jump on it. And the fire that happened in 1872 really put those early fire alarm systems to the test under difficult conditions, as we'll talk about. Now, major urban fires were a recurring and devastating feature of city life in the 19th century United States, just as they had been in earlier eras, but now these fires were beginning to meet the modern form of the Second Industrial Revolution city with its new technologies and taller buildings. Yes, Boston alone had experienced major fires in 1711, 1747, 1761, 1787, and 1794, just in the 18th century, according to Boston, a topographical history by Walter Muir Whitehall. However, the November 1872 fire in Boston was a notable meeting of the old and new in many different ways, some of which helped and some of which made the situation more difficult. For one thing, the building where the fire began in November 1872 was six stories tall and rapidly became a towering inferno due to its elevator shaft. That's something we talked about on our June 2022 episode about the emergence of elevator buildings in this period. When that initial building collapsed in Boston, it rained burning debris onto many of the neighboring buildings, including some with newer tar-based roofing, something we also touched on a bit in our asphalt bonus episode focusing on the same period. And that's according to Boston Observed by Carl Seberg, published in 1971. And as always, all of our sources, the various books that we used for this episode and so forth, and certain links will be up at a PDF at arsenalfordemocracy.com when this episode goes live. The entire block was burning within 5 minutes of the first passerby realizing there was a fire. That area of the city would end up burning for 18 hours before being contained and would still be sporadically causing new problems for a while longer. 776 buildings were lost, even though more than 700 of those were brick or stone. These had been assumed to be fireproof, but that did not account for all the paper and other flammable materials stored inside them, nor for the vulnerable roofs. And that's according to the book Boston Ways, High By and Folk by George F. Weston Jr., 1957. Now, including intentionally detonated blocks to create fire breaks, which Rachel's going to talk about later, 65 acres of mostly commercial land encompassing nearly 1,000 businesses were leveled. The death toll estimates ranged from a dozen or so to a couple dozen or more, according to Seberg and some of the other sources we looked at. Let's talk now about some of the specific notable features of this fire and the response to it. And for that, it's time to turn back to one of our trusty 19th century technologies, the telegraph. Rachel, what role did the telegraph play in the Boston fire of November 1872?
So Boston was one of the first big cities to experiment with fire alarm telegraph networks. And actually, the technology was established in Boston and the surroundings.
So, specifically my surroundings.
Exactly.
Newton Upper Falls, in my ward, where I'm a city councilor.
Yep, exactly. So I found one of the big players was Gamewell Fire Alarm Telegraph Company, which, as Bill mentioned, is in Newton Upper Falls. And I found their corporate history. And so it goes all the way back to the 1850s, specifically 1852, when Dr. William Channing and Moses Farmer of Boston developed the first practical telegraphic fire alarm system that could communicate the presence of fire and also the location of the fire. I'm going to explain that a little later. So a couple years later, in 1854, they sought a patent for the, quote, electromagnetic fire alarm telegraph for cities, end quote. In 1855, John N. Gamewell, a South Carolina postmaster and telegraph company agent, attended a lecture on the alarm system at the Smithsonian Institution. And later that year, he purchased the regional rights to market the system in the South and Southeastern states. In 1859, Gamewell purchased the total rights to the Channing and Farmer system. In 1865, after the Civil War, the U.S. government seized the fire alarm telegraph patents and auctioned them off. In 1867, John F. Kennard of Boston bought the patents and actually returned them to Gamewell, and they formed a partnership. And Kennard and Company set up shop in Newton Upper Falls, Massachusetts, to manufacture the fire alarm telegraph systems. A decade later, in 1879, Gamewell established the Gamewell Fire Alarm Telegraph Company. And a short while later, by 1886, Gamewell systems were installed in 250 cities in the U.S. and Canada, growing to 500 cities by 1890, with a new factory opening in Newton Upper Falls. So Gamewell was able to put their systems, really saturate the market for these telegraphic fire alarm systems in cities. And how did these alarm systems work? So there were alarm boxes set up around the cities that they were installed in. And these alarm boxes worked to alert the fire department to both the presence and location of a fire by sending a telegraphic signal that corresponded to the box number. So when activated, by opening the box up and turning a knob or pulling a hook, a spring-loaded wheel turns that sends that telegraphic signal to the fire station. And a receiver at the fire station would indicate that an alarm was active with flashing lights or sounds, or via a pen recorder, which is those like seismic looking devices where a pen scratches on a piece of paper. And so the signal that was sent and either transmitted through these lights or sounds or pen would then be matched up to the box number. And so then you could decipher where the location of the fire was by that box number. In later iterations, the translation would be automated to speed up the process. And in some unmanned installations, the box number would be transmitted via public address. So whoever heard it could go to the location of the fire corresponding to that box number. However, In this case, in the fire of 1872, the fire alarm telegraphy system failed for human reasons instead of technological reasons. So there was a big problem with false alarms, nuisance alarms. And so what happened is these fire box alarm boxes were actually locked, and a resident was supposed to find a designated block captain type figure who would have access to the key to open up the nearest fire alarm telegraph box and activate the alarm. But in this instance, it was very hard to find that designated key holder, and this really delayed the response time significantly and allowed the fire to spread much farther before any attempt to mobilize the firefighters was made at all. So this was a huge problem in this instance.
Apparently, in some accounts also, there was a relatively quick initial report, except that there was already a fire several blocks away. And so when the first report came in, the people receiving it apparently thought that it was just someone reporting the fire that was already being responded to. And it took, you know, 20, 25 minutes or so before they kind of put the pieces together and realized, oh, no, there's actually other reports coming in that there's a rapidly spreading fire. And as we said, between that time of the initial person seeing it and trying to report it and that response, it only took 5 minutes for that first building to collapse and set the entire block on fire. So this was moving pretty quickly, and it just, the whole thing was a very slow initial response time.
Yeah, another confounding factor is that in these early alarm systems, the activation required a complicated cranking to send that electronic signal to the fire station. So that further slowed the response time. So to address the nuisance problem with the false alarm problem, later installations of these fire alarm boxes would transmit a shrill noise when the box was opened. Or in some instances, the box would actually handcuff a detachable part of the alarm system to the person that sounded the alarm to make them easily identifiable to investigators.
Which is so also crazy.
Yeah, that just sounds really weird to me. But again, I guess this false alarm thing was a big problem. I'm kind of the mindset of better safe than sorry. So better to investigate fires that aren't bad rather than it cause these delays in the system for real fires that really delay the response time, really harm the efforts to put these fires out in a quick manner before they can spread to the surrounding buildings, such as what happened during this great Boston fire of 1872.
So on the other hand, even if the fire alarm boxes had been readily accessible and done everything that they were supposed to do, which again, here it was more of a human factor than a technological factor that was at fault, there were also a lot of other factors working against any kind of rapid firefighting response in Boston on November 9th, 1872. And it is unclear how much a faster alert time would have mattered in terms of producing a faster actual response on November 9th. So back on October 1st, 1872, the 1872 North American outbreak of equine influenza had begun in Toronto. This devastated all horse-based transportation in many parts of Canada and the northern United States, though not infecting humans. Fortunately, infected horses overwhelmingly survived, but while they were sick, they were often too sick to stand, let alone walk or pull anything, and this brought everything to a halt. A year ago in August 2021, we did an entire horsepower episode, number 392, about the extent to which pre-automobile cities in the U.S. depended on massive numbers of horses to get anything done. Unsurprisingly, therefore, when the equine influenza struck, there were enormous problems for months as it gradually swept around the cities of the northern United States in a big arc from Ontario, Canada, back around to British Columbia, Canada. There's an extremely clear and concise write-up of the 1872-73 outbreak in the Wikipedia article on equine influenza, discussing the spread patterns and the rapid forced shutdown of street railways, freight deliveries, the Erie Canal transportation, and more. The good news, besides the high survival rate for infected horses, was that an affected community would only be hit for a couple weeks typically, even as it was slowly spreading to nearby communities, and the horses would be back to full strength again after several more months. But it just so happened that in Boston specifically, this influenza temporarily incapacitating horses was still near its peak on November 9th and 10th, 1872, during the Great Boston Fire. And the result there was that there were simply no horses available to pull firefighting equipment. And I mean, no horses available. In the days leading up to the fire, according to Carl Seberg's Boston Observed account, city officials had made the smart decision to hire temporary firefighters, enough to double the existing force, just in case there were to be a major fire with no horses available. Crews, therefore, when they finally were alerted, began pulling their equipment by hand to the fire. Remarkably, the official post-fire commission report found that this only delayed crews by a few minutes once they had been summoned. But it did prompt the city to begin investing later in steam-powered equipment, sort of similar to self-propelled farm tractors, to avoid this potential problem in the future. Even when the hand-pulled fire trucks arrived on the scene, the city's water pressure proved to be really bad for trying to fight the fire. We're planning a separate episode on 19th century public waterworks, but it's enough to note here that many of these projects, such as the Cochituate Aqueduct system from the 1840s, were now already quite antiquated in Boston by the start of the 1870s, and the water pressure simply hadn't been increased to match rising building heights of the post-Civil War period and the growing number of elevator-equipped buildings. Moreover, lack of standardization meant that some of the firefighting equipment turned out to not actually match the nearby fire hydrants. Although, I would imagine that that was less of a localized problem and more a problem related to what I'm about to talk about. Most of the fire suppression for the Boston Fire actually had to be done with the support of outside steam-powered water pump vehicles brought in from all over New England as fast as possible, generally by rail. Within an hour of the blaze being spotted, the Boston Fire Chief had already asked every town within 50 miles by telegraph to send anything they could immediately. This was obviously helpful and critical, but again, probably created issues when it came to equipment standardization and interconnections. Another discovery that Boston made about the modern American city of the 1870s was that gas street lighting turned out to be extremely bad for fire control. This did lead to a few specific explosions during the 1872 fire, but mostly the city simply had to switch off the entire gas infrastructure, leaving Boston in nearly total darkness for some nights while the fire was contained and suppressed, and until the demolished areas could be disconnected from the rest of the gas network. And that comes from Stark's Antique Views of the Town of Boston, which is a book we'll circle back to later in the notes.
One failed tactic that was attempted was the use of gunpowder to raise buildings in the path of the fire to create fire breaks. Mayor William Gaston approved the use of gunpowder, and citizens began packing buildings full of kegs of gunpowder. Unfortunately, the gunpowder was not effective at creating fire breaks, and the primary effect was great injury to civilians and also flinging flaming debris at surrounding buildings, which, as we already talked about, this flaming debris landing on surrounding buildings, surrounding tar roofs, was just a huge factor in just making the fire worse. And so Chief Engineer John Damrell was forced to put a stop to the use of gunpowder, taking his attention away from the actual fighting the fire.
And
so,
this didn't come out of nowhere, though. We're going to do a separate episode on the Great Chicago Fire, which had happened the year earlier. And they did actually have to use significant amounts of gunpowder to create fire breaks there. And so this was not a totally bonkers idea. It just happened to not work very well in Boston and didn't really solve the problem.
Yeah, not at all. So many notable buildings were destroyed in the fire, including the Boston Globe and Boston Herald offices, the newspapers, as well as Trinity Church, which was an Anglican church from the colonial era. The Old South Church was one of the few buildings left standing in the district. However, overinsurance of buildings was common at this time, so many businesses had the money to immediately begin rebuilding. Another major part of the rebuilding process was improvements to the roads, both straightening the roads and widening them. Congress Street, Federal Street, Purchase Street, and Holly Street were widened. And within 2 years, Boston's entire financial district was rebuilt. And during this period of rebuilding, land values in the financial district rose dramatically, fueled by the significant improvements to both the infrastructure and to the new buildings. So these nicer, wider, straighter roads, these fancier new buildings, and also some plots of land were consolidated into larger, more valuable parcels. So there's a couple quotes here. Quote, although this calamity was a fearful blow to the business interests of Boston, entailing any amount of misery and distress, it, however, soon recovered from the shock, and with its usual pluck, refusing all proffered outside aid, has now covered the burnt district with some of the most imposing and substantial business warehouses, which are an ornament to the city. And that comes from Stark's Antique Views of the Town of Boston, published in 1907. And Mark Twain actually wrote about this, and he wrote, quote, "The burnt district of Boston was commonplace before the fire, but now there's no commercial district in any city in the world that can surpass it, or perhaps rival it, in beauty, elegance, and tastefulness." And he was actually quoted in Boston Ways, High by and Folk by George F. Weston Jr., published in 1957. And that was from Life on the Mississippi. And so this fire really was kind of the spark, so to speak, to really revitalizing this financial district, making it better, bigger, more fancy, more expensive, more elegant than before. So they really were able to recover. And I'm sure it's no coincidence that this was a financial district. So there was a lot of money, a lot of capital flowing into this rebuilding project. So what happened to Chief Engineer John Damrell? He actually resigned from the Boston Fire Department in 1874 in the wake of investigations into the fire by the Fire Commission. This commission was created solely to investigate this fire. That same year, Boston began replacing and repairing its water mains, which was one of Damrell's pet causes. And as Bill mentioned earlier, the water mains were not able to sustain the pressure needed to fight these fires in these tall buildings. Also, an additional new aqueduct project also began at this time. And although he resigned from his position as chief engineer of the Boston Fire Department, Damrell remained devoted to firefighting and public safety. In 1873, he founded the National Association of Fire Engineers, NAFE, which is now called the International Association of Fire Chiefs, IAFC, and he became the organization's first president. And he also served as a building inspector for the city of Boston, and he took that post very seriously. He was very serious about creating safe buildings that could stand up to fires. While Damrell was president of NAFE, they published a list of fire safety concerns in building construction, flammable and combustible building materials, excessive height buildings beyond the reach of ground ladders, which was a huge factor in making the fire hard to fight, fire escapes, water supply, space between buildings, corridors and open stairways, fire alarms, and having an adequate fire department. In 1877, Damrell was appointed Boston's building commissioner, and he served the Department of Building Inspection for 25 years. In 1884, Damrell petitioned the National Association of Fire Engineers to create a more formalized building code during his presentation of Building Code Report at an NAFE convention. In 1891, the National Association of Commissioners and Inspectors of Public Buildings was established by Damrell, and he served as the first president. A standardized building code wasn't established until 1905, the year of Damrell's death, when the National Board of Fire Underwriters published its National Building Code. And that is coming from the Wikipedia article about the fire. And so Damrell really took this opportunity, this tragedy, to really fight to improve the conditions and prevent another major fire like this from happening again in Boston. That public safety, that building inspection was a huge factor in making buildings safer and able to withstand fire better without endangering the buildings around it, which was a huge problem in the Great Fire of 1872.
I just want to highlight one point that you made there at the end, which is that those standards from 1905 came from the National Board of Fire Underwriters, as opposed to coming from the government. This is another thing that we're going to have to talk about and do an episode about, is talking about fire insurance and things like that, and the private sector role in firefighting in the United States in these cities. But you know, like we said, there's a whole bunch of different interesting topics that you can look at here when it comes to fires. And we're not just going to focus on cities as well. There was a topic related to a major wildfire in Idaho that ended up on our list that we mentioned at the beginning of the episode of Idaho-related topics. And that one has a lot of significance, not only for the state of Idaho, but for the entire country, or at least the parts of the country that have significant wildfire fighting activities on a regular basis. Rachel, any other closing thoughts here about either the Great Boston Fire of November 1872, 150 years ago this November, or the fire alarm telegraphy system from Gainwell and others?
Well, I think it's interesting that these systems are actually still in place today. It sounds like it's definitely more of a thing on the east, the eastern states, rather than the west, because I don't think I've ever seen these type of alarm boxes before. I don't know if you've seen them in person before.
Other than around here where they're everywhere?
Okay, then, yeah.
Yeah, no, there was a some sort of a power outage or 911 outage in Boston a few years ago, and someone was able to successfully use one of these fire alarm telegraph boxes that was still in place. And it worked and got the fire response they needed. I think a lot of people had thought that they were, you know, maybe disconnected or ornamental at this point, but there are still quite a lot of them that are in service. Not as many as there used to be, but they certainly are around. The Gainwell Telegraph building that we talked about, where the factory was in Newton Upper Falls, that is still there. It's not currently producing telegraph alarm boxes, but it's still called the Telegraph Building or the Gainwell Building, and it's I believe on the historic register and so forth. And you know, they've just done a whole revitalization project there, and it's you know, they've preserved some elements of the building externally but then renovated it for other uses inside. I think it's going to be office space, and it's just very cool. Come on down to Newton Upper Falls, Ward 5 in Massachusetts. That's my area that I represent. But yeah, these iconic red and white fire alarm telegraph boxes are all over the place still, even if they're not as commonplace as they were. And they definitely, this was sort of their peak area, but they were, as you said, a significant force on the East Coast for quite a while. I thought it was interesting too, the sort of Civil War aspect of seizing the patents and then the patents getting returned anyway, just kind of following that middle of the 19th century arc for so much of American capital in this country. But an interesting angle on this telegraphy stuff that we've been talking about a great deal in other recent episodes.
Yeah, and it's impressive that the technology is still in use, obviously an edge case, but that is it, that it still works. It still, there's the proof of it still working there, and over 150 years later. That's really impressive for this technology.
Well, that's the thing. And I mean, I think that also goes to the planned obsolescence episode that we did, is there was an era when they were making stuff in American industry that could actually last. And these were simple technologies that didn't break down and were functional and did not require a lot of maintenance and upkeep and repair to do the job for a really long time.
Right. I can't imagine another technology where the lines, without this kind of sustained maintenance program, would still be operational, especially like thinking about like telephone wires or like internet cables or anything. If you don't work on them and don't maintain them, they degrade relatively quickly. So it's, yeah, that's another point in its favor that these telegraph lines still worked.
All right. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for coming on this week to talk about fire alarm telegraphy and the Great Boston Fire of 1872.
Thanks. It was a pleasure.